Science in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Dinky. How are you, man?
I'm doing all right. Not too bad today in some ways, and in other ways I've had a bad night. But other than that, we keep plodding on, you know.
Good for you.
You keep doing it. How are you doing? You been doing all right with everything? You had a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Oh, thanks, man. I mean, I other than my problems with my car, I'm basically so far so good, you know.
That's good. Well, let's start this. We'll go, welcome to Two Pints in the Corner here, Rick Berlin. And I'd just like to say Two Pints in the Corner with Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain. Tony, unfortunately, is still recovering from illnesses and stuff. But Peter's here. But Pete, well, we're in a bad, you know, I'm on dialysis. Tony's had a stroke and stuff, and and now he's recovering from that. Peter's still doing his legs, but he's okay. He's a plodder on a
old age.
No, we're all young. You're only eight, so that's the way I look.
Well, then, so you're older than me?
No. I'm not older than you. I'm 78. I'll be 78 this year. But my wife, my wife is older than you.
Oh my God!
And I'm younger than all of you. So
it's what it is. We're all young. Our minds are in 25-year-olds, and our bodies are in 80-plus years of old.
You know, the odd thing is, we can all remember shit that happened in 1983. I remember it perfectly, you know. But
it's weird. But here's the thing: I wanted to start with. Was it just Luna before when you started with the group at that time period, or did you start with someone before that with Luna?
Well, the first band was Orchestra Luna, and that was a fluke, you know.
That was a fluke. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I was just basically, I had a job. I would take a job that would make me enough money to get a piano into the house. And I would try to remember the songs that I'd been writing because I wasn't really recording anything. No. So I'd have to play them every day. And I was on the third floor of this building in Somerville. And I was doing that. And this guy shouted up to the window and said, "Do you ever think of starting a band?" And I said, "Well, I guess I know, but I could give it a shot." And that was this guy, Harry B., who wound up running the Berklee Performance Center for a long time. And he was also pals with Bruce Patch, who was, looking to manage a couple of people. And so I started with my sister and Liz Gallagher, who I knew from New Haven. And we learned, 20 songs, just vocals. And then this was back in, 1970, 71. And then we said, well, let's add a bass player. And so I put up a notice at Berklee, and Scott Chambers decided he would come and learn the songs on bass and help singing. So that was, now there were four of us. And then it just goes on from there. Lisa worked at a club, Zircon, which was two doors up the street. And that's where Randy Roos had a band of his own. And so Randy and I were putting this band together. Would you be interested? He says, "I'm in." And so then we had to move because it wasn't a big enough place to rehearse. We moved to Alston. And then we auditioned a whole bunch of drummers. And I called my friend Peter Barrett, who was in New Haven, who I'd seen do spoken word and poetry and was a true artist. And we got him together. And then my sister Lisa, who was so shy on stage, I thought, well, we better choreograph this. I called my friend Barry Keating, whom I'd known from it's too long a story, but we were on this sort of pirate movie trip down in Grenada, West Indies, and I met him there, and I knew that he did theater. So we added him, Peter named the band, and from that first moment outside my window, 6 months later, we were signed to Epic Records, and then we thought this is the easiest thing in the world.
Wow.
We were dropped, you know, within a year of the record coming out, because Springsteen's Born to Run and Boston both came out on Columbia, and we were left in the dust.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, that's how it all began. L-U-N-A.
Well, September 5th, 1981, Berlin Airlift played the Channel, and it was formerly called Formerly Luna, because I've got older.
Yeah, that's correct. I love the Channel.
Well, the thing is about it, Berlin Airlift played 11 times there.
No shit.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say something, because I'm going to tell you what you played. You're not going to believe it. Berlin Airlift played 11 times.
Dickie's also going to tell you what you had for dinner last night.
No.
You don't want to know.
It's a big salad, I hear, you know.
Oh, my God.
Rick Berlin, the movie, played 28 times. Rick
Jesus
Berlin,
Christ.
The band, played 7 times. That was the...
No shit.
So that's over the years, from 1981 through 1991. And
that's wild, man.
You were a busy bastard there, kid.
Yeah, well, you can never get enough of that. It's a gift to be able to perform.
And that's what we're talking about, is the performance at the Channels on all the different bands and stuff and different people and whatever you had. I mean, I really enjoyed Rick Bell in the movie. I'll be honest with you. I enjoyed that whole
wonderful. That's great. I mean, that's funny you mentioned it, because the reason that we have this label now, Lunch Records with Paul Buckley, is because he came to that show where Berlin Airlift and Orchestra Luna performed at the Brighton Music Hall 2 years ago. And he said, "Is Rick Berlin the movie songs? Why aren't you doing that?"
Yeah, that stuff is great.
And so he said, "Oh, I want to take you out to lunch and talk to you about this." And so he took 18 songs in different formats and had them remastered by Brian Charles and released them on Lunch. And I said, after that happened, I said, "Well, you know, we've got this 8th record coming out for the Nickel and Dime Band. I'd love you to consider, you know, including that as a release." And he did, which gave us a tiny bump in a situation where there's really no serious radio play. And but it really, he's a great, great man, a great musician, and he was fabulous to work with, and he got us that birthday show. That was his idea. So Rick Berlin, the movie, is why we have this little label now, because of that. Because he'd go to the Channel. We were the first band he'd saw when he moved to Boston.
Wow.
And he took lessons from Joe Petrozelli at one point. And,
oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, I love a lot of those songs. I mean, and some of the recordings, now that they've been remastered, are really excellent. The thing is, I had 4 women in that band, 4 yep. dudes and 4 women.
Yep.
And they were all extraordinary, but there can be conflict when there's more than one girl in the band.
Always.
So there's a little of that. And Jane, of course, is more of a dude than a girl. I mean, she was never an issue and never has been. And she's played on every record of mine except one, you know. So God for her. Anyway, I'm rambling.
No, it's a history of Rick Berlin and the movie, Rick Berlin, the band, Rick Berlin and doing Berlin Airlift and Luna. I mean,
my name. It's a fake name, too. Jesus Christ.
But it was fun. Every time that I saw you play at the Channel with the movie, there was just so much excitement coming off of that stage, and then all the people giving it you back. Did you really notice all that in that big old Channel club?
Well, you know, the thing that always...
Well, I would credit BCN for why a local band without a deal would have a crowd that would know their songs, you know, because they would play a cassette of a song or a self-released vinyl. Yeah. You know, they play it at drive time.
Right. I thought
people would know it was great.
Great thing about you at the channel was that you guys were artsy, you know, and it wasn't something I was expecting to see. You know, I would just go to the channel and hang out if I had a meeting with a lawyer or a booking, whatever. Just go hang out, have a few drinks, and just, you know, see who was there. And your material, in my mind's eye, was so anti-channel, and yet it worked perfectly.
It was
you know? You just, I guess it was the people that you attracted and the fact that...
You know, that's very complimentary. I really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, it was shocking sometimes. You know, I don't remember any other band or performer who portrayed themselves in the way that you and your groups did that actually got away with 1,600 people loving every minute of it.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Well, I think, I have a couple of things to say about it. One is, now Paul, at our show on my birthday, stood back after he was done with all the stage managing and watched the show. He said, Rick, you didn't play a list of songs. You put on a show.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
And that was interesting point.
That was very interesting. It was a show.
And then the other thing is that, you know, when we played at CBGB's with Orchestra Luna, we had no business, you know, in the midst of the sort of punk pop revolution that was going on there. But they all loved us, you know.
And we
were happy and silly, and we wore, you know, gay makeup. And Hilly loved us, and then all these other bands, the Heads loved us, and the Ramones loved us, Danny Fields. They all, you know, were amazing. And even Lou Reed, at the side of the stage, when I got off, he gave me this big hug, and he said, I wish I had your guts.
That's impressive.
I'm name dropping, but it was, so I think we've always been on the periphery, but we've always been honest, you know, and I think, and I've been very, very, very lucky to have had phenomenal musicians and
that is certainly true.
It's creative and performance art in more than with the Berlin, you know, the movie, because there was just so much going on. I mean, that's the difference about it. It was totally different scene for that kind of stuff than what was other going off, you know, from, like you said, the punk or the industrial or this, that, and the other. You had a thing that everybody felt warm with afterwards, after each song.
Oh, that's a great thing to say.
You know, because that's what I got off it. I mean, I was seeing a creativeness going on that stage. Like
creative is the word. That is the word.
Every time that you played, it was just something, one of the songs that you got your heart into more than the other one, and all of a sudden you can feel the vibe, the energy coming off of you and the band as one. Mm.
You know, it's funny, you're talking about CBGBs. I mean, I can actually see you working in that.
Oh, moment. I can too.
and I'll give you a really funny story. We were showcasing Fahrenheit, and the only place we could get in New York that people would come to was CBGBs. Now, if you can picture Charlie Farron, who I love dearly, as a brother, on stage at CBGB's, well, I don't think he really understood what to expect, but it was in 20 years in the music business, it was probably the oddest night I have ever. I brought Richie Cordell, who wrote Moni Moni, and I Think We're Alone Now, and, you know, produced Joan Jett, and he produced the Stompers, and he stayed for 4 minutes, and he said, I can't deal with this anymore, and he got up and left. I was like, I knew this was going to be a bad night, you know, and it turned out to be a bad night. But
there's no predicting that.
Charlie wasn't meant for that room, you know.
Yeah.
you know, and look.
Well, I mean, I think it's, I think this, I think people respond. I don't know. You have no control over this. I mean, I think it's a gift to be able to sublimate experiences in your life and create something out of nothing, which can be a song, a book, a sentence,
yeah,
a stand up, a band,
a painting.
You know, and I think if you tell the truth and you're not nasty about it, people feel close to you. And so I've been incredibly lucky to have had a lot of heart in the room whenever anything I've been doing is happening, as long as the job that we do is at least 60% of possibility. I mean, I've played at punk shows at the Middle East all by myself, playing, you know, Happy Lesbians in the Snow, and that for some reason it works. And I don't know why. I always think I'm going to be spat at and thrown off the stage, but I think, I don't know. I go back to this comment that Dylan made. He said, the only time I feel like a real person is when I'm on stage, you know? And I think there's some semblance of truth to that, because it's a condensation of all of your essences, you know, in some way, you know?
Well, you know, I've always figured out that some people are just born to do one thing. And I think, I think people who know what they want to do,
mm-hmm,
and do it well are a lot different than 90% of the fakers. You know, I'll give you an idea. You know, I do a blog on Facebook every day with a cat. But I'm friends with, you know, like 1,200 people. And I keep getting these things of, you know, do you know this guy? Do you know this guy? And I'll tell you, like 30, 40% of the people who I don't know are sitting there with a guitar. And they're people you never heard of, who never played in the band, but they just, they want to look like they're an artist, or, you know, they're a quantity. And I just look at the people and go, you know, God, I've known so many wonderful people who are songwriters, musicians, whatever, you know, who have real talent, you being one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just sets some of those people a few steps higher than the normal human being, you know? And
I don't know about measuring one's height.
Yeah. And that probably came out wrong, but artistically, there are just people who were born to do what they do.
Yeah, like you are born to do what you do.
Exactly right.
Because you put your heart and soul into everything I've ever seen you do. And
well, I think it's a rare person who does not do that on a stage. I came to it late, tell you the truth. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was believed in acid and hippiness and traveling and hitchhiking, not having a place to live for years. And then I wound up in a house full of people that were all musicians and artists and in New Haven. And I'm going to try and write a song, you know? And so we got a piano from a church and I started writing, and it wasn't for any reason. It wasn't to put a band together. It wasn't to record. It wasn't to become known. And this is when I was 24, 25. And, but I kept doing it. It kept happening to me.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Wow.
It's proof is how many shows you did at the channel and enjoyed it,
every one
of them, because I even though I had other engineers work on the different nights when I wasn't there, and they all commented afterwards, that was a good show. I didn't know Rick Berlin did that kind of stuff.
I mean, Rick, you've got to have played more shows than almost any other Boston-based artist or band.
Yeah.
I mean, I was shocked when Dinky told me how many shows you played there. I was shocked.
It is crazy. I thought I would have guessed 9.
No, you were.
For all of my bands.
Oh, no. It's Berlin Airlift, that's 11, fun. Rick Berlin, the movie, 28, Rick Berlin, the band, 7. I mean, that was towards the end of the channel days when everything was changing again, you know.
Too bad it's gone.
You know, it's funny. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the last time I actually physically saw you. Was it Tim Collins's house? We were at a party, a birthday party for Nick LaHage.
Hmm.
Mark Parento was there. There was eight of us sitting around Tim's living room. And when Dinky said, you know, geez, we're going to do Rick Berlin, I was like going, holy cow. You know, I mean, that's like, as my cat says, wow, meow. You know, it was great. I mean, you have just been a real artist with a capital
A. It's the creativeness that you've done.
Exactly.
It's just the creativeness on every song. And then the songs that you didn't do, you were side of the stage watching other people. You were doing motions in general and feeling, you know, wow, that's good. I like that. I'll take that and use that. You know, you were learning.
It's so much fun, and it's such a gift
to
be able. I feel badly for people who don't have that sort of fifth wheel in their lives, you know, who it's job, family, and
that's it,
and the weight of responsibilities, and so there's a freedom that art gives you if you're. I mean, I think there are a lot of posers until they get into their 30s and they realize I'm still doing this. Maybe I am an artist.
That's true.
After all,
that's true.
That's
so
a true statement.
Once you see that is what you are, then you get into that car and you're not going to get out of it until you crack up. You know. So
we know that.
I think it's just. You know, people say, so what do you do? Are you a musician? I say, no, I'm not a musician. I'm a songwriter.
There you go.
And I think it's really a different thing. I don't know what the chords are. I don't know what they're called. I just put my hands down on the piano, and if it sounds interesting, I'll work on it, you know. And I think that's – and also I've been writing. I don't consider myself an author, but I've been writing ever since I was in my late teens, I think. So – the words themselves also are critical to me, and in a way that are not offhand. I'm sure any songwriter. I'm certainly not a Nick Lowe kind of genius, but I think every songwriter works really hard on their words, and I do too. And I think often the last thing you get in a live show are what the lyrics are, and at the same time, if they can be somehow transported to one person in an audience, you've done it. You've done your job.
Yeah.
You know?
Meaningful lyrics, you know, to a lot of bands
hopefully.
Are hard to come by. You know, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, I represented somebody who I loved to death, but as long as it rhymed, it worked. You know,
and
I'll just say there was deepness missing. That's all. You know?
What was missing?
Deepness.
Oh, huh.
Well, it's
yeah. I mean, it's almost as if they're not your damn songs. I mean, they seem to kind of fall out of the sky to some extent, you know, and you have to, it's the Nick Lowe quote: if there's a song walking down the street and you don't shake its hand, someone else will.
You know? That's true.
That is a great line.
It's my
line.
Favorite songwriting quote. You know, well, he had another really great one. This one I really love. He said, let's say you write a love song about a girl and you're in their early 20s. And then 40 years later, you can sing that song. It's about a completely different person.
Yeah.
And it still works.
Yeah.
So that's a good song.
That's a good song.
That's a good song. Yeah, for sure. I like that.
Yeah.
One.
So, I mean, I think the last bit of it for me is that I don't really get uptight if nothing's coming out, you know, and then wham, you know, there's going to be four or five.
And then you've got it captured. Do you sing all these songs in the bath at night?
That again? I'm sorry.
Do you sing all these songs that you write in the shower at night and stuff like that and get all the echoes going?
No. Once it's done, I can't even remember them. It's terrible. I mean, I've got this new little tiny thing I say, if you want me to write you a song, give me three sentences and I'll write you a song. It'll cost you $150. If you want me to make a video of your band or of something that's $350. And so I've had, I mean, one of the more difficult things to do is to have something you want to say. So if somebody gives me that, it's nothing. It's bang, bang, bang. You know, I can write the song pretty quick. You know?
That's just so creative.
It's like human AI. You know?
That's a good one. Holy fuck. I love that.
It's yours, my friend.
It's a self-defeating sentence. Really cool.
Yeah, exactly right.
Wow.
So did you also go watch, when you weren't playing, did you also go to the channel to watch anybody playing that was that you were going to enjoy and stuff that you thought, oh, I better go watch?
Sure. No, I definitely did. I mean, I remember seeing Iggy Pop in there. I remember seeing, I'm so bad remembering names, but I would go there a lot. Yeah, sure. And it was a great place to hear people. And it was also, you felt important even if you got nowhere on that stage, because you had lights and sound that were large.
Yeah.
And then you had an audience that knew your tunes. I mean, one of my favorite things, what I used to do in there, it's just terrible, but I used to fart right into the microphone because I wanted to hear it at soundcheck through those speakers. And then Laurie Sargent would come up, Rick, how can I use this microphone now? You know, you're covered with shit particles. So,
oh my God.
I do remember farting into the channel PA, and it was like a thunderous thing. It was so awesome.
Now that's art, okay? I'm going to tell you, that's art.
With an F.
I see Larry Sargent coming up and telling you off about that stuff.
Oh, she did? She was horrified.
That's funny. That is funny.
I like the funny ones. Yeah, well, it's creativeness.
There you go, sure. I mean, a fart is one of the few things that you can never predict sound or smell. You know, so it's what, at least you can't lie about those. I mean, it's the only thing Trump does. It's not a lie.
I've just had a bad night of all that, and I've gassed the whole house out. I mean, I can't figure
it out. Yeah, Nancy's filing for divorce in the morning.
Yeah, she's had enough of the damn wind bunnies, we call them.
A wind bunny.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, you know, I've known a lot of people who've said Dinky's full of crap, but sometimes it really is.
Awesome.
Love the wind bunnies.
So you guys have known each other for years.
We met each other in the club.
Yeah.
Peter was managing groups, and we met each other when he was doing
like
that.
Like in the early, mid-80s, I guess.
Yeah. Uh-huh. 84 is when I came into the club. You'd already been in there a bunch of years. You'd already been in there.
I had Charlie and Sal and Johnny A.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great list.
Yeah. Bobby Whitlock.
Yeah, you was Berlin Airlift. You did it in 81, 82. You did in 81, you did three shows. In 82, you did one, two, three, four, three shows in 82. And then in 83, as the Airlift, you did one, two, three, four, five.
Holy shit.
And, you know, you were there so much, they should have charged you rent. I mean.
Or turned me over to the mafia. Oh, my God.
You're too creative for that.
I guess they've got, I don't know. I did 10 years at Jacques, so I should know something about the mafia.
Yeah, you should.
You should. But it's, you know, all in Boston, there was just way it was over the years, and it's done its stuff. And at that time, it's creative to let you create what you want and stuff and have a good time, as long as people were enjoying themselves and drinking lots of booze and going out of there all crapped out, shit-faced and everything, so that they could say, hey, that was really, really good. They wouldn't be that way if those guys love that stuff, you know. I mean, that's the bottom line about it. But at the end of the day, it was a creative time in the 80s for all of you guys.
It was.
All of you guys, everyone that came through that was local from there was creating some amazing stuff and progressing as they went through the channel. Once I was watching like Gangarine play when they first started. And then within a month later,
the headliners.
The headliners, but they were so good. I mean, it was just on that particular Sound of Music, that particular.
You know, I look at some of the younger bands and I think about what it was like when you finally worked your way up to be a first or second band channel. And some of these kids with in quotation marks, but some of these younger bands are sitting there opening for national headliners.
Yeah.
I mean, where in the name of God do you get a chance to do that today? You know,
it's extremely unlikely, you know, especially because who's ever managing a national band is going to want somebody who opens for them who's a draw.
Right.
And how can you be a draw if you don't have national reach or at least large local reach based on radio? So it's a tough thing. I mean, so I got to know Gordon Gano because of working at Doyle's, which is where I met him. And so he had us open for the Femmes at MGM. I guess it was a year or so ago. And it was incredible. And they gave us an hour and a half sound check. They said you can play for 25 minutes, which is really long to open for somebody like them.
Yeah.
And we owned that crowd of 5,000 people before we played a note. I mean, they were uproarious. It was incredible. And they didn't know any of our shit. And they were kind of singing along with us. It was crazy.
Isn't that weird when they do that?
It is weird. And it's the thing is that it told me is that should we ever have a chance to play in a large venue, we'll win them over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine what you would do in a large venue if you had gotten airplay with a song or two?
Oh my goodness!
Fuck yes, of course.
Oh my goodness! Would be amazing.
It would be, and I don't regret it. I mean, because every artist wants to have the largest platform as possible because they just want to feel relevant. But I think being able to write, learn, record, perform isn't just the most beautiful thing, and I mean, I wouldn't mind dying with a microphone in my hand, but we'll see.
You know, it's funny.
You're probably going to do that.
I went into the straight world at Northeastern University kind of after my Mighty Sam McClain days in the 90s sort of ended.
Huh.
And, you know, with Sam, I mean, we toured Europe. I had a great time, you know.
Wow.
And I got into the real world. I've told Dinky this story, but, you know, the people I was working with, I had known them all for 20 years because my brother was a vice president at Northeastern. And, I went to the athletic events and social events.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I finally came on to work, then they started asking me questions. What was it like to do this? What was it like when you – and I have to use my stock answer, which is I had to give these people whom I was now working with the C and D versions of the stories. Because if I had told them the A and B versions, nobody would have either not believed me or disowned me. You know?
It's true. It's like that. I mean, I wrote a book with Carter Allen, and some of the things, the only thing that was like sensational – to the people in the Inquirer was Joan Baez gets electric in jail because I hooked up to the electric chair at Sing Sing for power. You know, I mean,
that's awesome.
So, I mean, you know, they don't look other than that, the silly stuff in some ways, because that was normal for us. We were going to venues with my sound company, and I'd after hooking to the main power in the place so that I can run all those big blue amps. When we got to the channel and all those big blue amps, I put in a separate circuit straight from the mains coming down from the and it would be on a giant panel under the stage there and all the breakers.
Amazing.
And everything. And It was the only way to service some of this stuff that we got because it needed lots of power, lots of electricity and stuff. And you have that going off, and then you have all the sound coming out of it, and you know you get people who are creative like yourself, and you can hear every note. You
isn't
can
that
feel
amazing?
Every note.
Isn't that amazing that you can be on the floor of the channel? I mean, I used to sit around the main bar with a drink in my hand.
Yeah,
and you'd walk around there, and there's 1,600 people just absorbing, you know, whatever was coming off the stage.
Except Man of War.
Yeah. But he heard everything. I mean, it was just pristine. I mean, it was as incredible a night to go and enjoy music and hear, you know. I loved that room. I loved hanging there. You know, I don't quite frankly remember ever seeing a bad show by a headliner that I could think of off the top of my head. And, you know, it was a great place to go and meet. I kept office hours every day. I covered dates for, you know, all of the people I represented. But I think I said this last week to, you know, who we were talking to. I said, I did more business on the floor of the channel than I did in my office.
I think you did too, Rick.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
You were talking everybody up because the people of the other artists in town, like Larry and people like that, would come over to see Rick Berlin, the movie, would come to see and play and do this and enjoy themselves. And
that's wild.
And you were talking to everybody. I remember doing that at the side of the stage when you would come off and, well, you had to go to the dressing room, but before you got to the dressing room, there was about 10 people you were chatting to before you got left.
And I said to myself,
he's got it down, that lad. And the musicians had it down with you all along the way, and it had been fun, you know?
Well, it was informal there. It was formal and informal.
That's a great one. Point.
I like that one, Rick. That's really good.
You know, you weren't trying to be a hotshot. You're just having a good time with a lot of people that gave a shit.
And you were creating what you wanted to that night on that particular song, and making art that was so done well, so well with the music, with the genre that was going off and what have you. And you were well on top of the scene of that particular style of music. And in town, you were the only one that I could see.
I agree, yeah.
You know, they do that. Everybody else had, I got to do a bit of metal because that's the scene right now. Or we got to do a bit of punk because that's the scene right now.
I don't think that was done on purpose. It was just what we did.
And the other thing is musicians by nature are insecure.
Exactly.
So sometimes you sort of run back to mother, you know, when you need to, you know.
There's a song, Run Back to Mother.
Oh my God. Now you created another one, Peter.
There I go. Not writing this shit down.
Watch out.
Well, he's on the podcast and you'll be writing this stuff down. Oh, my goodness. It's a good time, and you're looking at the stuff that you did before. You said earlier on in this conversation about the stuff that you were looking at from the Berlin Airlift, those songs that you and now you were saying that now we've got an album with this, that, and the other because these songs are, you know, it's the creativeness of dramatic art, and I love every minute of it. You know, I mean, I like all the genres that came through. I mean, I love the reggae, I love the world music, I love the older stuff which I worked on over the years, you know, and what have you. But then all the stuff was the creativeness that came out with Face to Face, with you, with even the Stompers, to me, and the Fools.
Oh, for sure.
You know, they all had their creativeness in that particular genre they were doing.
You know, you just said something very interesting, and I'll look at the Stompers and the Fools as perfect examples. Sometimes people were so involved in the show on stage that they forgot that these guys were writing really good songs, you know? I mean, the song always mattered to me. I can remember Richie Cordell and his Bronx accent going, "It's the song, man. It's the song. I don't give a shit about the. It's the song." You know, and it was really true. You guys were the song. You know.
So Rick, we've got about 5 minutes. So let's talk us anything up that you're doing new now. You're putting all the stuff from that them days together.
Well, Nickel and Dime has been together for now 14 years. But there's only two people from the original Nickel and Dime. It's me and Ricky McLean. And now it's just five of us. And in some ways, it's the most magical amalgam of musicians ever. It's one thing. And we've just finished our eighth record with Brian Charles, and it's I'm really proud of it. And I don't know what's next now, because nobody's going to give us a tour, and we went from playing Brighton Music Hall on my birthday to playing The Plow, and they were equally exciting and wonderful. But these great players can get other gigs and do other things, and they ought to, and I want them to.
Yeah.
But, if I can hold these five together and make another record, I've got 20 more songs I'd love to learn,
and
start on that.
That's great.
Yeah, it's as long as I find the fascination of saying something I might not have said before and find a bunch of people that want to do it with me, onward we go,
That's the way to look at it.
I have no other choice.
And at eight, you're still on top of it. That's the key that we've just found out in this conversation.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah. I mean, I love this. I love, the songs are my kids in a lot of ways.
There you go.
Really proud of them.
No, that makes sense.
There you go.
That makes sense.
You pull out my phone and show you a song rather than a photograph of my cat.
I like that. Because the movie comes along as it is. I mean, to me, it was always that creative stuff that worked more than I thought it would do at that time period.
It can seem like a cover-up, I mean, you see a phalanx of choreography for some giant touring band, and it becomes tiresome after a while. And it's almost a deflection from the songs themselves.
Songs, man. It's the song.
But what? It's the songs. What Ricky would say. Ricky would say the songs came through tonight, so we're okay.
Yeah. The problem is in a lot of this new stuff today with all the digital working, we have a big, huge problem. It's not live. People put their whole shows on a flash drive.
Yeah, exactly
put
right.
Put it into the computer. Yeah. The computer sets the sound. It sets the lights, and you have to keep your time to a click track.
Yeah, a click track. And people at the shows, people that these shows think they're actually seeing live music.
They're not seeing live. They're seeing people trying to perform live, but they're not really amplified. It's not human AI. It's just a complete, debacle. There's one guy lost his flash drive. He had to quit the whole tour because there's no way he could sing or anything on live. That's disgusting.
Oh,
that's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
Well, you remember the whole Milli Vanilli bullshit that went down?
Yeah.
Everybody,
oh
my God, look at this. Well, this makes Milli Vanilli look like nothing.
Exactly, exactly. That's the issue. Because
the thing is, there's a lot of tremendous artists and musicians writing incredible stuff right now, And I talked to Oedipus the other day about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I said, you need to find somebody in some town that nobody's ever heard of, that should get an award at that place for just doing it and having it matter.
Yeah.
He said, Rick, I can't put anybody forward. I just vote. But I mean, and I wasn't advocating for myself. I just said that there's an incredible amount of material and depth out there that nobody will ever hear.
Yeah.
except as a close friend or his wife or something.
Yeah.
You know, that's worthy of acknowledgement for, say, somebody's done this for 25 years. Let's give them a hand. You know, and I think that would be so great because we're all completely mesmerized by fame, fortune, and wealth, you know, and that is never the whole story.
No.
And it doesn't mean that those that have it don't deserve it. And it doesn't mean that those that don't should not also be in the three-wing circus and see if people like what they're doing. You know,
that is anyway, true. On that note, we're going to call it at the end of the podcast. That we just had 45 awesome. Minutes and stuff. And
well, you're awesome.
And you're awesome. I mean, the stuff that you've been doing, you got to keep doing it. I don't care. You could be 150. I don't care. You just keep doing it. I mean, that's what we do.
I'll send you our new record so you can listen to it.
We will get that organized then, and we'll put little snippets up on.
Just snip away. <That'd be awesome. laughs> I love you guys.
Hey, man.
Keep the faith.
This was great.
This is Rick Berlin and Dinky Dawson and Peter Limbo signing out on Two Pints in a Corner.
Aye. Much love.
I love it. I got that aye.
Take care, Rick.
Take care, Rick.
You too.
Thank you very, very much, Rick. Appreciate it, mate.
This was really enjoyable.
Yeah, enjoyed it.